best speech because of my heritage and the loud bright colors that I wear. I was a target because I'm a fashion misfit. And the outfit that I'm wearing, brothers dissing it. While I stay calm and pray, leave me be. But they squeeze the parts of my date's anatomy. Why, Lord, your brothers have to drill me? Because if I stop to hit this man, they'll have to kill me.
Reference to a roundtable that our colleagues here participated in, titled "Is Abolition Global? Iran, Iranians, and Prison Politics." We have with us Arash Davari, who will actually be the moderator. I'm going to disappear like a deist god. I'm going to vanish in a minute, and Arash will moderate the session. And with us also is Golnar Nikpur, a co-editor of the Iran page, as well as Arash, and Navid Mansouri, also the same. And our guest author and writer is Omid Tufiqyan. He told me that we pronounce it like we do in Arabic with a qaf, and I was really impressed. So Omid Tufiqyan, welcome to our roundtable. I am happy to have this roundtable addressed directly in our broadcast, and I will leave it up to you, Arash, to lead the way and kind of wrap this up within a particular, you know, time limit, so we could actually leave some for the leaders or the listeners and those who are watching to go to the roundtable.
So let's get right to it. In the roundtable, you all speak about incarceration, not only in Iran, but also of Iranians abroad. And I'd like Omid to speak on that, on the linkages between the two contexts. But before we do so, I'd like to ask Navid and Golnar to say a little bit about incarceration in Iran, how you think about incarceration in general, and how you think about it in Iran in particular.
Sure. Navid, should I start?
Yeah.
Okay, so thank you all for being here and for having us on the roundtable, Bassam. The idea for the roundtable came together because we all work on prisons and incarceration. And the way that my particular work is historical. I'm a historian, and I'm working on a project, on a book, on the history of prisons and incarceration in modern Iran. So my interest in the topic and my the way that I approach it has to do, you know, it comes from a place where from an early time in my life, I knew people who had been incarcerated in Iran. It's a personal project for me. And I don't always, you know, say that as I go, but I think that for a lot of us and a lot of us on this roundtable, that we have connections to people who've been incarcerated. So part of my own thinking comes from that. But historically, what I'm interested in is the transformation of Iran into what I call a carceral society. What do I mean by that? I mean that Iran becomes, really in the Pahlavi, early Pahlavi era, a modern state that approaches and solves the issues of several different sort of social issues through new systems of police surveillance, policing, and incarceration. So the idea of citizenship starts to be formed through the idea of having people who are good citizens on the outside and bad criminals or security threats on the inside, right? So this kind of idea of an inside and an outside, of a line between the healthy, safe polity and the socially deviant or degenerate, and the idea that you can actually cure that sort of social deviancy through carceral methods, that comes to be a really important part of the Pahlavi state. So a big part of the book that I'm writing is actually about Pahlavi Iran, because that's when this, you know, enormous sort of institutions of policing and prisons get founded. But the idea that you can solve problems like sexual deviancy or drug use or border crossing or any number of other things that the modern states thinks of as problems through policing and incarceration. So that's what I mean when I say Iran becomes a carceral society. And people have to deal with that. They have to understand how not to get arrested when they go out in the world. So one of the things I always say is that what it means to be modern in Iran, in the United States, and in Australia, is that we're all going around all the time trying not to get arrested. We know what things might make us vulnerable to policing, and we try to avoid those things. But some of us can't avoid those things based on issues of social difference, race, gender, class, etc. So that's also a part of the carceral process.
You said border crossings, and I'm wondering if I could actually interrupt the the flow that I first introduced and ask Omid to speak a bit about that, because in the roundtable, he specifically talks about his understanding of incarceration as a bordering practice. So I'm wondering, Omid, if you could kind of pick up from there and speak about the linkages between talking about incarceration in Iran and how you talk about incarceration and think about incarceration in your work.
Definitely. Thanks very much. This whole experience has been wonderful. And like Bassam was explaining to us earlier, I've learned so much from the research of my colleagues as well. It's helped me think about border crossing, bordering practices. It's helped me think about immigration detention, and particularly its relationship with the prison industrial complex, the similarities, the differences, and the continuities. So essentially, my interest in this area came from a number of different fields and a number of different areas of study, but in particular, how Australia, as an outpost of the British Empire, was set up as a penal colony, and how this particular kind of experience, this particular kind of invasion and dispossession of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander lands in Australia ended up multiplying, replicating, morphing into different kinds of carceral sites. So very quickly we saw Indigenous peoples taken from their homelands, put into different kinds of carceral sites, different forms of containment. So missions, reserves, cattle stations, different forms of forced labor, essentially slavery. Australia also used islands off its coast to as prison sites, as carceral sites for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. We see this changing forms, manifesting in different ways throughout Australia's history, modern history. So during the Second World War, for instance, First and Second World War, Australia detained indefinitely Japanese, Germans, including German Jews, Italians, people that they saw as being a threat to national security, people that they associated with fascism in Europe or in other parts of the world. So essentially, this history of creating prisons, multiplying prisons, creating new technologies, I refer to these not just as carceral technologies, but as bordering practices, because they're associated with so many other things that happen in Australian culture and society and politics. So here, when I think about immigration detention, it's important to identify that in 1992, the Labor government in Australia, so not even the Conservative Party, the Labor government actually began mandatory indefinite detention. And that involved setting up detention centres, putting a lot of money, hiring a lot of, subcontracting a lot of companies to manage them. And a large number of the people who detained, people who were crossing borders, coming by boat from Indonesia, first going to Indonesia, then trying to seek asylum in Australia by boat, many of these were from Iran. In fact, the number of people coming from Iran seeking asylum in Australia increased dramatically in 2009 in the post-election, after the post-election uprising. So essentially here I'm trying to give a very brief history of Australia, its relationship to bordering practices, incarceration, and how prisons are linked with immigration detention and border politics.
And so off of that, can I actually ask a question of Navid, which is, once we start to think about borders, we start to think about these kinds of problems in a global context. And one of the themes that's addressed in your roundtable is abolition and abolitionism. And you all start kind of thinking through the prospect of understanding abolition and abolitionism as not just a US-centric phenomenon or movement, but something that can also have a certain kind of purchase and political power abroad, beyond the borders of the territorial United States. So I'm wondering, Navid, if you could speak a bit about how you understand abolitionism and how you think about it in relation to your research on Iran.
Hi, thank you. So my own research and how I've become informed about what might be an abolitionist tendency within the history of modern Iran is very much in correspondence to how Gulnar understands modernity as basically a condition where you're evading arrest. And throughout the history of modern Iran, beginning during the in the Pahlavi dynasty, there was many ways in which people were devising and crafting ways of resisting arrest or evading censors. And they were doing so through in ways of trying to voice and enact practices of defense against what was effectively a carceral state. So in that context, in the absence of, say, a word that corresponds directly or is a transliteration or translation of abolition, it's through my own, you know, local sort of, in a sense, in the United States, my own learning about abolition here, that I have a concept or a category that I can apply as a heuristic to try to organize and understand these kinds of movements in a way that corresponds to or is analogous or runs parallel with histories of resistance against the carceral state here. So in that way, I think that we can write and think about the history of Iran and try to see and perceive abolitionist tendencies or practices, even if as of yet, there isn't an explicit solidarity, so explicit of an organized solidarity within these two contexts.
So while we were doing the roundtable, some events actually took place in Iran where three young protesters from the November protests against the fuel hikes in Iran were given a death sentence. And then there was a viral international kind of solidarity campaign with the hashtag Edom Nakonid, do not execute, that effectively delayed, at least for the moment, the death sentence. So I'm wondering if you could each, just to wrap up, speak a bit, perhaps we can come back to you, Gulnar, speak a bit, and then to Omid, if you could speak just a bit about this movement, the status of these political prisoners, and how you understand it in relation to your work as scholar activists of abolition.
Yeah, for me, this is a remarkable, you know, again, I speak as if I put on my sort of historian hat, and it's a remarkable instance of something that is a longstanding phenomenon. You know, the first time that the Iranian state mitigated sentences against Iranians due to global pressure from activists around the world was in the 1960s. That continued in the 70s and forward, that kind of spearheaded by expatriate Iranians and by, in some many cases, exiled Iranians, but picked up in solidarity by different kinds of movements, right? And that has produced sometimes strange bedfellows, people calling for actually kind of different things, but able to agree on the importance of certain kind of flashpoint cases that show us the issues that are kind of globally resonating. And anti-death penalty work is one of those things. Prisoner of conscience work is another one of those things. In my own work, I try to push on that. I mean, I'm extremely sympathetic to those calls and have joined in them as well. I try to push, though, and say that we need to be more capacious about what we mean by political prisoners. What do I mean by that? What I argue and what I believe is that the process by which the overwhelming majority of those who are in Iranian prisons and have been incarcerated in Iran from the 20th to the 21st century, they're not incarcerated on so-called political offenses. Iran, the state itself, delineates between political prisoners on the one hand, who they call security prisoners, and ordinary prisoners on the other. But political prisoners who get a sort of outsized voice are a small percentage of the prison population, the majority of which has always been on minor drug offenses. So how do drug offenses come to be carceralized? That's a political process. How do we think about sex work? That's a political process. Why are Afghan refugees held captured at the border and held in border camps the way that we have similar sort of refugee camps here in the US or in Australia. That's a political process. And we have to think capaciously about connecting these movements. I think in Iran, although there isn't an abolitionist, you know, the abolitionist framework isn't Iranian. And I struggle all the time with thinking like, okay, you know, what is the line between a kind of solidarity in language and movements and wanting to actually have sort of localized understandings driving those movements, right? But there are actually really important movements in Iran trying to bring, for instance, public health understanding into prison reform along public health lines. Because there was a huge, for instance, HIV crisis in Iranian prisons. So public health advocates, people who are advocating for a different type of drug policy, ending of the war on drugs, decarceralizing things like minor drug use. Those are different movements than the political prisoner movements. And to my mind, we have to find a way to start having them talk to each other. Because I think that they're sympathetic to each other in really important ways. That's where the framework of abolition is useful, even if it's not, the language is itself not indigenous to the Iranian context.
So, Omid, in response to the question about the recent campaign, in the roundtable, you speak about a couple of other hashtag movements that draw attention to some of the links between refugee populations and displaced persons in the Australian context, but also incarceration within Iran. So I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about how you responded to the question about the hashtag movement that occurred this past spring.
Certainly. This is a really important point. I'm glad you raised it. It gives me the opportunity to talk about the way that marginalized and persecuted and stigmatized groups in Iran often become marked as criminal, become forced to flee, to become sort of people that don't find can't enjoy citizen rights in the same way that, say, people from the majority group in Iran can. And even that's a contentious issue, what citizenship means and how it's practiced in Iran. But in particular, marginalized groups we find, for instance, Kurds, for instance, Baluchis, Hazaras who live in Iran, these people become part of the displaced and the exiled, and looking at the population of detained people in Australia in immigration detention, we find a large number of these particular groups represented there. But one point that I would like to make, and something I didn't make in my responses to the questions in the roundtable, is that there's also a very large number of Persian Iranians, and many of them aren't people who have suffered discrimination based on socioeconomic status or have been restricted or limited in terms of their potential to live a prosperous, free, flourishing life economically in Iran. So there are also people who have fled for other reasons related to religion, politics, related to different kinds of social and political mechanisms within the society, not necessarily related to the state. So there's Persians, but there are also marginalized and persecuted groups fleeing Iran. So I think the hashtag campaign is really important because suddenly people are starting to see the status, the situation, trials of marginalized and persecuted groups as relating to them as well. So the dominant group starts to see the marginalized as being significant. And if something isn't done, if people's rights aren't defended, if people aren't recognized and their situation isn't transformed, those mechanisms of control, what I refer to as bordering practices, forms of containment, exclusion, persecution, that exists on many different levels in society, then ends up becoming used against the dominant group in the society. So I thought that following this particular issue related to the hashtag campaign about the executions is significant because it may create a new form of abolition culture in Iran.
In response to the question, Navid, you you kind of close the roundtable out by speaking a bit about how you think about a kind of critical, if you will, anti-carceral left politics from your situation in the United States, the proverbial belly of the beast, if you will. I'm wondering if you could put into words and articulate a bit how you understand your politics from your position in the United States.
Right. Of course, the difficulty a lot of us know in voicing criticism of countries that have historically been at the butt end of the U.S.'s imperial policies is that you know, a depiction or a representation of those places as places of domination is often, you know, fuel for the fire of the imperial war machine, a U.S. war machine. And unfortunately, also the space for dialogue and communication is oversaturated, is overdetermined. And so our rhetoric and our talking points can easily just become no longer ours and in the service of aims and objectives that we would rather not be a part of. And so that's a great difficulty. How do we voice a critique, a very necessary critique of practices and of domination and institutions of domination in Iran, while distancing ourselves from the process of coming up with reasons for intervention economically, military, and otherwise? And as far as I know, I mean, I was saying that I do think, of course, that, you know, dissimulating or lying, I can only get you so far. But the way I was thinking about it is, you know, just twofold. One is that I do think of Iran as sort of suspended between contending visions of carcerality, of what a different visions of what a carceral state ought to look like, one coming from the United States and one coming from within Iran. And I think that kind of way of thinking about it allows us to avoid a mistake we so often make. I make reference in the roundtable to this really profoundly insightful claim from Eddie S. Glott, who said that, you know, it's not that the United States is exceptional in its sins, but what makes it exceptional, what's really exceptional about the United States is that so many people here are so unwilling to acknowledge the wrongs that it's done. And often, as we know, those of us who've thought about, you know, Orientalism, you know, have read and thought about Said and all these things, we know how common it is, how common and convenient of a strategy it is to displace all of the evils of the world, all of the wrongs of the world onto, you know, the lands that are theirs and not ours, you know, and so often the Orient. And so partially it's, you know, in trying to articulate and devise and craft a critique, we have to think about our standpoint. And so often I think that in the United States, especially because that's where I'm thinking from, we confuse an ethical and moral standpoint with that place for living, with this country. And so trying to hold those apart to say that we can articulating a true critique of over there without assuming that our moral and ethical standpoint corresponds or maps onto the United States, that the place we are speaking from is innocent and is for us the bedrock or the foundation from which we can weigh and measure the wrongs around us and in the world. And so that's roughly how at least I've come to try to orient myself in this really chaotic, you know, moral and ethical universe that we live in.
While we have a little bit more time left, I wanted to actually ask about the event where that generated this roundtable. So we were, Gulnar and I were sitting in the audience at a talk at Columbia University some time ago where Omid was on the stage. And Gulnar asked a question about the kinds of designs of prisons that were being used both by the United States and also by the Pahlavi state during the Cold War era, I believe. And that generated this really engaged back and forth between Omid and Gulnar at the moment, which then spilled over into a conversation afterwards, which then eventually led to this to this project. So I'm wondering if you all could treat us by reconstructing some of that exchange a bit and giving us some context as to how this conversation between a researcher in the United States and a researcher in Australia emerged.
Oh, now you're asking us to have good memories on us, which that's like the before times, anything before COVID. I cannot recall. Being in the same room with each other seems like a really distant past. But I think that if I remember right, we were discussing, you know, one of the things that I brought up and that I find extraordinarily fascinating is that Iran in the 1960s starts to use blueprints taken from prison in the United States, in Illinois. And that those blueprints are used almost immediately. I mean, they're taken from this prison that was built in the 60s and they're used in the 60s in Iran. And then they're also used in Israel and in New Zealand and in some other places as well. But because of that connection to New Zealand and thinking about the different sort of cartographies of carcerality, I was curious to hear from Omid about how he thinks about these things, you know, how specific they are to Australia versus, you know, because I, you know, the what I think is really global about abolition is that it's a language of solidarity. There is something irreducible in the language of abolition to the context in which transatlantic slavery existed. I mean, that's where the language draws its power and its sort of movement history. But at the same time, the imaginary, and this is something that Angela Davis says again and again, that our imagination of these things has to be global because carcerality, colonialism, capitalism, they're global. So, you know, I had at the time been very curious to hear another person, you know, basically on the other side of the world talking about these same things. And Omid's work is looking at a really different set of circumstances that still have these really important resonances with the Iranian case. And I think in some ways we are taught to think that Iran, contemporary Iran, the Islamic Republic, is a kind of particular kind of, enacts a particular kind of barbarism that you don't find in other places, like in free Australia, right? So that was part of my sort of thinking in that there some of these histories are simply linked in ways that we don't always know.
Omid, I'd like to give you a chance to respond as well.
That was a really exciting event for me. I met wonderful people. I got a chance to see you again, Arash, but I got a chance to meet Golnar and talk to her about her research. And to be honest with you, I had no idea about the connections between the United States prison system and the design for prisons in the United States and its relationship with Iran. So it really pushed me to think a lot deeper about these interconnections, particularly because we're talking about an industry, and you know, when you're talking about an industry, you're thinking about corporations. You're thinking about capitalism, racial capitalism here in particular. So this was really important for me, and this roundtable discussion also encouraged me to think a lot deeper in terms of Navid's work as well, and how abolition politics, especially the resistance movement in the United States, going back to the early 20th century, really informs the way abolition is taking shape now and how it's playing a role in different forms of resistance within the United States and also beyond. So for me, that particular event where I was talking about Behruz Bouchani's work, No Friend But the Mountains, which was written during his time on Manus Island, incarcerated on Manus Island, which is part of Papua New Guinea. It's a province of Papua New Guinea, and Australia has basically using it as an extraterritorial site to detain undesirables, people, refugees who it wanted to warehouse outside of Australia to keep out of sight, out of mind. So that particular event, there were so many things I wanted to talk about in terms of anti-blackness and also the relationship between Australia's immigration policies, its border politics, its border violence, and issues around race. So when Gordon brought that up, it gave me an opportunity to talk a little bit more about about it, and we continue that discussion later. But here, I think for me, it's significant because thinking about abolition in the US context and in relation to anti-blackness in the US is important to think about in relation to anti-blackness in Australia, which is understood differently. It's analyzed differently and represented differently. Here, indigeneity and anti-blackness are combined in terms of the discrimination against black bodies. And there's a long history in terms of the influence between Australia and other places in relation to oppression, but also resistance. Two examples, the Black Power movement in the United States in the 60s had a major influence on Aboriginal resistance in Australia, and also the policies in parts of Australia, especially Queensland, ended up influencing apartheid South Africa. So there are a lot of interconnections here that are really important to consider. And I'll just finish off by saying that I talked quite a lot about the oppression of Iranian peoples by the Australian state in terms of immigration detention, but also we shouldn't forget that black bodies are also being oppressed, also being violated in the Australian detention system. So we have people from Sudan, people from Somalia, Ethiopia, Eritrea being held indefinitely in Australian detention, also being killed in Australian detention. And on top of that, the people in Manus Island, the indigenous peoples, and Nauru are also black people who are being exploited, not only to oppress other people, other vulnerable people, but also being exploited for their land and also for their moral fabric, in terms of their moral fabric as a former colony of Australia.
I just wanted to say one last thing, if I could, which is that just as in the 60s, the US shared, that these, blueprints for prisons were sort of globalized. Today, what we see in 2020, the big thing that I'm seeing in Iran is that the importation and the sort of also the creation in Iran of all sorts of new technologies of surveillance, facial recognition software, biometrics at their borders, et cetera. And so all of these practices, these bordering practices, which have bordering technologies, which are run, sort of sold by multinational corporations, are profoundly global. They're profoundly transnational. So again, the sort of conversation stems from the desire to make our responses to those things equally global and equally up to the task of sort of dealing with the movement of peoples and ideas and so forth.
Thank you all so much. We'll end it there, and please be sure to the audience to check out the roundtable.
1950s, it probably wasn't surprising to people to see you leading this current project that you're on. You have a nickname, an evocative nickname, the Garbage King of Beirut. How did you get that title?
I call myself the garbage man, not the garbage king. I don't like royalty that much, actually.
Recycling has been Ziad Abishakir's calling for decades. And in Lebanon, which has faced years of crisis over its garbage, it was a much-needed skill. Ziad's the CEO of the company Cedar Environmental, and he got the Garbage King nickname from foreign news coverage of his work. But now, Lebanon is dealing with a different kind of waste. Thousands and thousands of tons of debris and rubble from the Beirut port explosion on August 4th. Today, we're looking at one small way of cleaning it up. I'm Malika Bilal, and this is The Take.
As we speak, about 100 days after the blast, there's a huge issue with debris right now. They still have them sitting in a plot near the Beirut port, and no one knows what to do with it anymore.
It's been 111 days, to be exact, since the blast killed more than 200 people and injured thousands more. And in that time, Lebanon's government has resigned, and an investigation has started. Who knew that more than 2,700 tons of ammonium nitrate had been stored for 6 years at the port? And why didn't anyone do something about it? It's not clear that's really going to be resolved from the investigation. It looks possible that no high-ranking officials are going to be charged. Meanwhile, there's still no new government, the economy is paralyzed by a financial crisis, and the aid being offered by the IMF and other governments is on hold unless Lebanon implements serious reforms. It's a familiar form of political paralysis for Lebanon. But now, there's also the long-running economic crisis, another wave of COVID, and the need to get all the damaged houses ready for winter. We're talking to Ziad because this recycling initiative is an example of the real engine of Beirut's reconstruction, civil society. Since it started, more than 100 tons of glass from the explosion have been recycled. Since the blast, we know and we've seen evidence of the amazing work that the Lebanese people have been doing to clean up their own neighborhoods in the aftermath of that explosion. So I wanted to talk to you specifically about the glass. In those first few days after the explosion, what did the streets look like?
When the blast happened, I was in the Badaro area, and the building really shook very hard, and I could hear all the glass shattering. 10 or 15 minutes afterwards, I went down on the streets to check and see the extent of the damage or if anyone in the neighborhood needed any help. And in my neighborhood, the extent of shattered glass was phenomenal. You could see up to 10 inches of broken glass on the sidewalks. And at the same time, you could hear the glass crackling and then, you know, falling down on the streets. Glass was everywhere. Everywhere you walked, you had glass.
In the days after the explosion, volunteer groups came together, one after another. Many of them had been active during Lebanon's revolution in 2019. Ziad had already worked with two of them, Muwatin Libnane and Beitna Beitek, and they started focusing on the glass. Windows, doors, mirrors, every pane in the area near the blast had essentially shattered at once. It was being found in people's beds, in jars of rice, inside shoes, not to mention covering the streets.
We had teams picking up wood, others picking up metals, other teams picking up just construction rubble. And I was working with the team that was supposed to be collecting glass. So after we made our first collection, I sent it as a sample to the factories in Tripoli.
Tripoli is Lebanon's second largest city, about an hour north of Beirut.
And it was a good move to do that because the first sample we sent, they immediately came back to us and they said, listen, we cannot work with this. This glass has been picked up from the streets and it's mixed with a lot of rocks and sand and a lot of impurities. It will take forever to clean it up. We cannot work with it.
So then, as you mentioned, it was civil society that picked up the pieces. You all realized that you were going to have to sort this glass by hand. Talk to me about what that looked like.
After the feedback we got from the factories, I recorded a 4-minute video.
Marhaba, أنا زيادة بشاكل.
Explaining to people that not all the glass we will be able to recycle. We will only take the glass that fell inside, not on the streets. So anyone who was willing to recycle their window panels, we were going to put forth a public WhatsApp number where they can send a location pin. And people responded tremendously to that. They started sending locations, sending pictures, some of them even calling, saying, hey, I have glass for you. Why don't you come and pick it up? The first few days were really very hectic for us.
But the recycling teams had another setback when they sent their next batch of glass to the factories in Tripoli.
Again, they rejected it. They said, listen, it's not as dirty as the ones that you picked up from the streets, but this is still dirty. It's going to cost us money to inspect it, remove the debris from it, and this is something we cannot do right now. And even though at the time I did not have the budget, my immediate response was, we will cover the wages of you hiring 2 extra people to do that. And I did not have the money for it. But somehow I figured that I will get the money somehow. This was too important to let it fail right now.
Who decided what it would actually be turned into? And what did it get turned into?
At the beginning, my aim was to just send this glass as free raw materials for the glass factories. All I wanted them to do was, as struggling local industries, I just wanted them to benefit from free raw materials. And in the line of the discussion, I very casually asked, how can we help you more? What do you need? And they said, help us sell more of our stuff. Help us find new markets. We need to work. So I sat down with the factory owners and we designed a line of about 7 or 8 products. And I said, listen, I don't have money from the initiative because I barely have enough money to cover the cost of your people who are inspecting the glass. But I'm willing to take a personal chance on this and I will try to sell it on the market in Beirut. And every profit that it will make, we will come back and buy more from you. And this is how it started. I thought that I was throwing away about 10 million liras. 10 million liras were, at the time, they were worth about $6,000. I said, you know, I don't care. I need to help these people. They helped me achieve this dream of recycling all this. They helped me. I need to help them.
So how well did it sell?
Oh, we sold out everything we bought from them in a matter of 1 week or something like that. We had to shut down our website for like 3 weeks to stave off people from ordering online.
That's incredible. Why do you think it appealed to people so much?
First of all, these were simple designs, and this was something that we all grew up seeing. And lately, they disappeared from the market. Like the traditional Lebanese jug, which we call the brie, it wasn't as proliferant as it used to be before.
The jugs and jars came from about 100 tons of glass that was able to be recycled. But that's still just a small fraction. Ziad estimates there were about 4,000 tons shattered. And the cost of rebuilding Beirut is estimated to be up to $15 billion. The scale of the problem is enormous. But within that, these small initiatives are keeping the city together until that rebuilding does happen.
The fact that this was coming from the glass, from the shattered glass, there was some kind of a poetic justice to all of this, that you could bomb us or you could, whatever, you could try to harm us and we will always find a way of making something good out of it and something that connects all of us Lebanese.
And that's The Take. If you want to see the glass for yourself, just check out our episode description. You'll see links to more there. This episode was produced by Alexandra Locke, with Amy Walters, Dina Kispe, Priyanka Tilvey, Oniwo Hacha, Nagin Odiai, Ney Alvarez, and me, Malika Bilal. Alex Roldan was the sound designer. Natalia Aldana is the engagement producer. Stacey Samuel is the executive producer, and Graylin Brashear is Al Jazeera's head of audio. Special thanks to Taimur Azhari. We'll be back on Wednesday.
As we continue to fight the spread of COVID-19, there are new support programs in place for those who need them, including a stronger, more accessible EI and 3 new recovery benefits. Continuing to support Canadians now will help keep us safe and make Canada more resilient. Visit canada.ca/coronavirus to learn about the new income support programs. A message from the Government of Canada.
When your parents need your help, you're there. When your kids say something's wrong, you're there. When your friends have a rough day, you're there. Be there for yourself the way you're there for others, as it's normal for these uncertain times to bring out negative emotions or anxiety. If you're finding it difficult to carry out daily tasks, there are solutions. Visit quebec.ca/gettingbetter or call Info Social 811. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
See, they snakes, we hate war. We hate war, but they hate peace. So we make war and I make peace. That's a great war we were made for. We were not made to just lay dormant. They stay on top, they pay the cops, they take office, they make laws and then say stop. They say war just makes war, but then they force us when they force us on lame force. And then they say that they're brave warriors and saviors, but they're fake prophets. They make war because they profit. They make rockets till all sides and all lines they pop. Watch the masters of war.
We make sure that there's order. We just follow orders. We just fill orders for more ballistics, munitions, equipment, permissions, provisions. We just design defense systems and ship them on time. Listen, my job is complying with city bylaws and minimizing innocent lives lost from my bosses, both at home and abroad. For instance, drones with a bomb can resolve conflicts, all while limiting high costs. So why not? All businesses strive to expand. Wars just provide us a chance to supply and demand. Our stance is we make instruments. We don't create incidents.
Hey, this is Roxanne Shante, and of course you know I am listening to CKUT 90.3.
The rhymes you're about to hear me recite are dedicated to all of those that bite.
People think I'm jiving, know they must be crazy, don't see their misfortune, yes, it's just lazy, just see the grand zombie, my yellow belt your choice on, ain't afraid of no tomcat, fill my vein with poison, walk to the fire, fly to the smoke, see my enemy. It's our antidote, no. Walk on pins and needles. See what they can do. Walk on gates and up. Can't go missing. See what I'm going to do.